Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports. The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN, New York.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Rick Wolf's Sports Edge. I'm your host, Rick Wolf. I have three topics that I'm eager to cover with you this morning. Now, later on in the hour, I want to give you a quick update regarding that impromptu survey that I did last week on the most pressing issues in youth and amateur sports. As you might imagine, I received quite a bit of feedback on that wide-open topic, and I want to share with you some extra follow-up thoughts. And then, for those of you who did go to my website at AskCoachWolf.com and had a chance to look at that video of yours truly playing minor league baseball in my late 30s, I want to give you the surprise ending for my stint with the South Bend White Sox back in 1989. But first up, we are, of course, in the middle of the Final Four weekend in college basketball. March Madness has been a lot of fun this year, especially because of the amazing run of St. Peter's. But this morning, I want to discuss with you a new and potentially significant development when it comes to how young basketball players are being taught the game of basketball in Australia, and why this new approach should be, at least in my opinion, somehow it seems to be welcome news to American basketball fans. And of course, we'll take your calls at 877-337-6666. Look, I think it's fair to say that when it comes to showcasing young basketball players these days, a great deal of the spotlight is shined on individual talents. Now, kids today, at least here in the United States, seem to gravitate towards individual stats, such as how many points I scored or how many rebounds I pulled down. And look, let's be honest here. A lot of the top players in the NBA and in college play the game as though it's all about isolating their own talents against the other team. Now, for me at least, this makes for a very boring and, quite frankly, sort of a selfish kind of game, which really isn't especially entertaining. And nor does it lend itself to winning games, which, of course, is the overall purpose of the sport. So, this past week, did you happen to see the article in the New York Times about what's happening with the development of point guards in Australia? In short, the NBA's Global Academy, which opened just a few years ago in 2017, it was started because the NBA wanted to find more ways to grow the game abroad and to develop high school age prospects from around the world. This program has quickly honed a reputation for producing a certain type of elite young player, point guards from Australia. And in the Times article, which was written by Scott Cacciola, he interviewed Marty Clark, who's an Australian who runs this program in Canberra. And it totally emphasized that it's all about passing, not individual stats like scoring. And by the way, my thanks to a longtime Sports Edge listener, Ken Kolb, for making sure I saw this article. In any event, Marty Clark, who's in his 50s, described the distinctly Australian concept of mateship. And that's what he calls it, mateship, which prioritizes teamwork, selflessness, and loyalty. Says Clark, Quote, culturally, it's instilled in us from a young age that it's more about the team or the family or the business than it is about the individual. And if you work in that direction, you, as a basketball player, will be rewarded. Case in point, well, you can look at Josh Giddey, the 6'8 guard from Australia, who was drafted 6th overall by the Oklahoma Thunder last year, has had a fine rookie season in the NBA before getting hurt. So, you know, the fact is, in addition to mateship, Marty Clark also emphasizes what he calls positionless basketball, which basically describes much of the modern NBA, offensive sets in which the players can swap roles and pretty much operate all over the court. In Canberra, players learn all aspects of the game. It does not matter if you are a point guard or a power forward. In short, everybody is doing ball handling and everybody is doing post work. Now, you get the idea. In a world of American basketball with a focus on AAU and club ball, is all about individual scoring and the so-called look-at-me approach, this Australian philosophy sounds to be totally, well, refreshing and pretty much a new page. In fact, for those of us who grew up at a time when the Knicks were all about passing back in their two championship seasons, this Australian approach sounds like a return to how basketball is supposed to be played. It's team play in basketball. And apparently, NBA scouts and top college coaches are really paying attention to this Australian way of developing players. So, is that now the future of the NBA in college and high school ball? All right, that's a little background. And so what I did was I decided to ask Noah Savage, who's been on the show several times in the past. Noah, of course, does college basketball on air for ESPN, to come on the show this morning to discuss all this. Now, Noah was an all-Ivy League sharp-shooting forward at Princeton, and he's also a product of AA ball in this area. And just for the record, so we're clear and transparent, Noah happens to be my son-in-law. Okay, Noah, good morning. How are you today?
Hey, Rick, good morning. How's it going?
Good to talk to you, Noah. Now, look, you heard what I just said about this situation in Australia. And you know, we've talked about other developments with basketball in recent years, but is this new approach with Australia on focusing on just passing and passing, making a great pass is more important than just perhaps making the score? Are we on the verge of seeing a major change in the development of young basketball players?
Well, I don't think so, Rick. I think it's been an approach that's been around a long time, especially, you know, not to stroke my own alumni group here, but especially at Princeton, you always had guys who passed, dribbled, and shot. And I think every 5-10 years, there's an article about this where they either go, well, the European way is the right way or the Australian way. But whenever I hear somebody, a fan, come up to me and they go, I love the college game, but I can't watch the NBA. They're too selfish.
Yep.
I go, you need to watch the current NBA, which has an incredible international presence. They score more points than ever. They pass the ball at an elite level. So I think this is kind of a retread of a story we hear every 5 years where we hear, well, you know, foreign players can really pass, but Americans can't. But I think this is the way the game is going and has been going for a long time. You can't just be a big center who doesn't shoot a three anymore. You can't be a center who doesn't put the ball on the floor or can't pass. And if you watch the NBA today or you watch certain teams in college, they can really pass the ball. You know, I think about Davidson with Hyunjoon Lee, who's an NBA Academy alum as well. And there's a bunch of guys and women actually on the women's side who are part of this NBA Academy. So I don't know if it's a new approach, but I think it's the right approach.
You know, as I mentioned, of course, you played at Princeton, but you came along after Pete Carril. And, you know, for those of us of a certain age who watched Princeton basketball back in the day and Pete Carril, and it was all about that weave and trying to sort of lull the opposition into a sense of, like, security, all of a sudden there'd be a backdoor pass for an easy layup. That, to me, is sort of like almost in lockstep with how the Knicks did with their two championship seasons. It was all about the crowds would always sort of applaud and celebrate the great pass, which led to the score. I'm not so sure that happens any much so much more these days when it comes to the NBA. Do you feel that way or not?
Oh, no. 100% does. I mean, if you watch teams like the Utah Jazz, You watch teams like the Memphis Grizzlies. The passing and the skill level in the NBA is higher than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the Knicks game yesterday. The score was 69-60 at halftime. I mean, teams score a lot of points because they really pass the basketball. Now, at the youth level, I don't know if that is trickling down yet because there is so much garbage on the internet about skill development for young players where they're practicing moves that you beat one guy, there's two other guys, you try to beat them rather than just throwing it to the open person in the corner or down low. So I don't know if it's trickled down to youth sports yet because I see, you know, I watched the McDonald's All-America game last week and it was brutal. It was absolutely unwatchable, selfish play. And I know it's an all-star game, but high school guys coming to college still have that, you know, get to the hoop at any cost mindset sometimes. So I don't know if it's trickled down to the youth level at this point.
That's exactly, and we're talking this morning with Noah Savage of ESPN, and that's what I'm talking about. I mean, the fact is, you look at the kids today, and again, we'll go to your own experiences with AAU ball. You were basically being groomed to try to impress college coaches and scouts to say, "Look at me, I can really score. I can just isolate me, and I'll beat two or three defenders." What they're doing with Australia with the Global Academy is they're trying to go in the opposite direction, saying, "No, we're going to emphasize pass, not so much about trying to do it yourself as an individual star." And yes, we know, of course, that there are great, great scorers in the NBA. We know that. I mean, Kevin Durant had a career high last night, but, you know, the team lost. I mean, the fact is, it's not always necessarily about just scoring. It's how do we get the passing to, as you say, to really basically make sure everybody's involved. The team is just, defenders can't move as fast as a really well-placed pass. And I think that's what we're trying to get to. I think if the Australian kids are being taught this, why aren't the American kids being taught this as well? Are they afraid they'll be bypassed by the coaches and the scouts?
No, and I think, like, you can't generalize, right, for everybody and say nobody's teaching this. There's plenty of good coaches that teach passing and teach movement off the ball. But I think that the impact of social media is huge. The impact of what does your Instagram look like? What does your highlight reel look like if you're a young player?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of celebration of individual skill. And, you know, guys like Kyrie Irving who split the trap and then they beat two more guys with these, you know, it's like basically 1-on-4. I can't stand watching him. And if you're a young player and you like him, I think your head's probably in the wrong place. But there's hundreds of NBA players who are phenomenal passers that guys can look to. And I think Australia has just created a pipeline from Patty Mills to Joe Ingles to now to Josh Giddey of guys who are unselfish players. And college coaches do value passing and they do value team play. So a lot of times you get AAU players and high school players trying to impress a college coach and they actually hurt themselves more by trying to play selfish. And, you know, it's like trying to play to impress someone else rather than just play the game to win. And then, you know, the recruiters will find you if you're good enough.
We're talking about these great point guards and how they basically add a refreshing touch to the game. I mean, looking back in your own career in college, I mean, Jeremy Lin. I mean, when Jeremy Lin played for the Knicks, I mean, the game suddenly blossomed and it opened up, and it was such fun to watch Lin, dart here and dart there and make the great pass and just sort of sped up the game. It was much more entertaining. Now, I know you played against Lin in college. Why don't we see more guys like Jeremy Lin? I mean, I just don't understand why more college programs aren't trying to focus on that kind of talent.
Well, I don't know if you watched the game last night, and it was an all-time great Final Four game between Duke and UNC. I thought you saw a ton of great passing, and you know another point to make is that the officiating, I think, in college is still not at the level of the NBA.
Yeah,
and every year we get a video that says this year we're going to call hand checking, this year we're going to call the moving screens, this year we're going to clean up post play, and in November they call it, Rick. But by the time we get to March, and especially before the tournament starts in the conference tournaments, it is a wrestling match at the college level. Because if you look at the skill level of players, it's incredibly high, but the scoring doesn't match how high the skill level is sometimes because there's a lot of fouling that goes on and goes uncalled. And even in this tournament, I think there's been games that have been incredibly physical. So I think if the college coaches want the game to be more free-flowing, you know, there continues to need to be more emphasis on freedom of movement. And that's another huge reason I love the NBA is that the refs are phenomenal. And the players are so good that they adjust to the officiating, and that's why we've seen scoring skyrocket on the NBA level. But I think it is a product of the passing. So, you know, if you're watching with a young player, point out the good passes. Point out the spacing. You know, watch Klay Thompson play and dribble twice the entire game and get 30 points. You know, you've got to point out and teach the game to young players. You can't just have them watch on Instagram and, yeah, they're going to see the highlight individual play. But if you watch the game and explain, look at the spacing, he's standing in the corner, or look at the way he cut back door and got somebody else open. You know, I think the game is in a great place, but it needs to be taught to young players because the influence of social media is staggering.
Well, I was going to say, I think you sort of did a nice job there of crystallizing the issue that on one hand, the coaches at the amateur levels should take the time and obviously, you know, highlight, let me show you a great pass and how this whole play develops. The score was easy. It was a dunk or a layup. But to get to that point, somebody had to have a real presence, have real sort of perimeter vision on the court, set up that pass, make it happen. That's the key to success. But again, as you said, right now we're still in a world, especially here in the U.S., when it comes to Instagram and highlight reels and social media, because that's what the players think that that's going to attract the coaches and their attention. And you know, maybe there's some validity to that, too. I mean, look, we know that coaches want to get guys who can score. But the fact is, if you want to win, you got to get those players who really do have the ability to see the open man and make that brilliant pass.
Yeah, and if you watched the game last night, and it was probably – there's probably eight NBA players on the court at any given time in the Duke UNC game, but most of the scoring, if you tracked most of the scoring, it was penetrate and kick, open threes,
yep,
or it was drive, get fouled, get to the free throw line,
mm-hmm,
and in some cases it was offensive rebound. So it was fundamental play, and it's amazing how much I see young players working on dribble moves and step backs and all these kind of very advanced plays that you probably shouldn't make unless you are pro. But most of the scoring still comes from the free throw line, 3-point line, and layups.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what was amazing to me during this tournament was Villanova makes the Final Four, and a huge reason is because they were the number one free throw shooting team in the country. So as much as you can dress up the game and you can, you know, pack, you know, 10,000 fans into the arena and you can have a million sponsors, the fundamentals still come through at the end. The team that makes free throws, doesn't turn it over, and knocks down open shots is going to win the game. So, you know, again, when I'm watching with a young player who's in high school or in middle school, I try to point out that guy's the best player on the court because he shoots 86 from the free throw line, he makes every layup, he makes open jump shots, and he doesn't turn it over.
Yeah.
All that other stuff you don't really need to become a good player.
We're talking with Noah Savage of ESPN, we'll come back after the break, Noah. We'll take some calls as well. Of course, the number here is 877-337-6666. We'll take a timeout. When I return, we'll continue our conversation about what's happening in terms of teaching kids how to play basketball the right way. Stay with me. Talking this morning with ESPN's Noah Savage about this new development in Australia in terms of developing basketball players with the emphasis is on passing and team play more than individual stats. And we'll get to your calls in a second at 877-337-6666. You know, here's to me is the bottom line on this, Noah. And, you know, if you're a college coach, and we know the games are all about whoever team scores the most points, that's how you win in basketball. We get that. But if I'm looking to recruit top players, I think the first thing that everybody looks at is, oh, well, this I'm bringing in a bunch of kids who can really score. And then you bring all these kids in who can score, but turns out they're not very, you know, skilled in other parts of the game, like passing or like being an unselfish teammate. That could really backfire. Now, as I said earlier on, when you were playing AAU ball not that long ago, I mean, clearly you and your teammates, you must have always thought about my scoring am I going to capture the attention of all the college coaches because I score a lot? Or did you ever give any thought about your passing or other parts of your play?
Well, me particularly, no, I didn't, as you know. But the problem with AAU basketball is there's games you play to win.
Yeah.
And then there's games you play to showcase.
Okay.
And when you're showcasing, the ball isn't getting reversed back to the other side. It's going up before it comes back around. So if you ever watch a G League game, it can get kind of brutal. Every guy who catches the ball is trying to do something with it. And that does happen in AAU a lot, where the first time a guy gets it, he's trying to go, he's trying to get into the paint, he's trying to score. You know, you're not playing purely to win. Now, that being said, I'm not going to hate on AAU basketball. There's a ton of AAU coaches who do a great job, and it is important to get seen. It's the number one way you're going to get seen, you know, during my era and today, is to play AAU.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about what the motivation is, it is to showcase your talent. It's not to win the game. So there's a lot of guys who get to the college level, and they've actually played very few games where winning or losing mattered or was the most important thing.
Interesting.
Even at a high level.
Yeah.
Because they've played in a million showcases, but they've never played, we got to win this game or we go home. We got to win this game because there's always the next tournament, you know, next weekend, the weekend after that. So that's the difference, is that, you know, it's like the Herm Edwards. You play to win the game. Except in AAU, you play really for the exposure. So it does become a different motivation.
Interesting perspective on that. I'm glad you pointed that out because, yeah, I mean, this is all part of the pipeline to get noticed by coaches. But in effect, as you said, very few of these talented players actually played games which have a real meaning to them in terms of winning or losing. It's more about, again, showcasing their talents.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And just as a side note to that, Rick, is that I know a college coach who won't recruit a kid unless he sees him play on his high school team as well as his AAU team. And he's like, the competition is not as good at high school, but they're running a system and they're trying to win. That's what he says. He's like, it's a little bit more like college where you're trying to do something on offense, you have a system, and you're trying to win the game.
Hmm. Interesting. That's good to hear. Okay, let's take some calls. Let's start this morning. Let's go to Ralph in Manhattan. Hey, Ralph, good morning. You're first up on the Fan.
Good morning, Rick. Good, Noah, what's happening? You know, I'll tell you, basketball is the ultimate team game. To my knowledge, you got to look the best shot each time down. And, you know, when you're hinging your bets on a three-point shot, that whole strategy is down the drain. The three-point shot has done more damage where it used to be a luxury. Used to be something you relied on to get back in a ball game. It's now a strategy that's used throughout the ball game, and that's pretty much destroyed the game. But again, this team game that we so love, it's got to come back to where it used to be. You know, I hark back to the New York Knicks. I go back that far, 1969-70, when these guys played the ultimate team game, probably the best five ever assembled on a basketball court.
Yeah, Ralph, that's an interesting perspective as well. You and I have debated this too, that, you know, through analytics, the NBA has decided, well, it's a better and more productive way of trying to win games if we shoot more three balls than take a 15-foot jump shot. Ralph, thank you for the call this morning, as always. Noah, what about that? I mean, doesn't that run counter to the whole Ralph's point?
Counter to
play?
With all due respect to Ralph, I hard disagree. Couldn't disagree more. The three-point shot is great for the game. It's great for spacing. And the shooters nowadays, both at the NBA, college, and high school level, are the best shooters we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you practice it, your feet are set, it's a great shot. And, you know, that's not just coming from me. That's borne out in the data analysis, that a good open three-point shot is a good shot. And also, it doesn't really have anything to do with team play because, you know, penetrate and kick basketball to shoot threes like Villanova does, it's beautiful basketball. You know, they get easy twos at the hoop, or they get penetrate and kick wide open threes. I think it's good basketball.
And I think I should point out, in all fairness to our listeners, that, yeah, you made your reputation as a three-ball shooter yourself. So this is sort of like near and dear to your heart, correct?
No doubt. But also, you know, players shoot more of them, but they practice them more. So it's become a good shot.
Okay, let's move on. Let's go to Steve up in Westport. Hey, Steve, you're next up on the Fan. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. The first time calling, but I have to tell you, I was compelled to call because my all-time favorite basketball player is Dollar Bill Bradley. He combined playing for the Knicks in their heyday and the highlight of being a fan of the Knicks in the early 70s, and then following his career even earlier at Princeton.
Yep.
But you were talking about Pete Carril and the motion offense, the backcourt screens, moving off the ball. I'd really be interested to hear, Noah, about your firsthand experiences, just the philosophy of how Princeton ran that backdoor offense, from a firsthand perspective. It seemed to me that they moved the ball through a center at the high post, and then somehow they magically would have all these backdoors. They worked the clock, and there was a weave. But I would just love to hear, since you were part of the team, just what was the philosophy of how that they made that all happen?
Number one, it was all set up by the 3-point shot, right? So it was a lot of great spacing with shooters around the center, and then when you play a 2-man game with a handoff, you can either come off and get the handoff and shoot the three, or go back door. So again, to our last caller's point, all those beautiful back doors are set up by the threat of shooting it from the outside. So it all starts with really shooting.
Now, and Steve, thank you for the call this morning. Now you mentioned early on about schools like, and as we obviously see so much more parity in college basketball, schools like Davidson and Richmond and schools like that, well, they really do seem to emphasize the passing, and there's very little dribbling, very little personal isolation. Are we going to see more of this, do you think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we saw it up and down the tournament. You saw with St. Peter's really skilled guards with, two wings, the Drame twins, who were really skilled as well, Casey Nadefo. I mean, they played really hard on the defensive end, but they're a good passing team too. And even with, I love the way Villanova plays. I think that they are the modern blueprint for how to play college basketball. They drive, they jump stop so they don't charge, and then they are able to kick it out to shooters, and they usually have five shooters on the court. But, even with Duke and UNC, you've got excellent passers. So I think we can oversimplify and just go, kids today don't pass.
Yeah.
I don't think that's accurate. I think that there's a lot of nonsense on social media about individual play.
Yeah.
But the best teams in college basketball have an incredible efficiency, which means how often do you get a good shot and how often do you make it? And a lot of that comes from passing the basketball.
Let's move on. Let's go to Bob in Little Ferry. Good morning, Bob. You're on the fan.
Good morning, Rick. How are you? Everything doing fine with you?
Yes, sir. How about yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Hanging in there. Nowhere. I don't know who you are, but welcome aboard. Rick is probably the most popular show in the country, for goodness sakes, in regards to subjects like this. You guys want to see pure point guard play? Let's go to the game that's played under the rim. You go take a look at Paige Beckers at the University of Connecticut women's basketball team.
Yeah, she's
you
want to
talk
good.
About pure guard play? Don't interrupt me about these guys putting up 50-foot three-pointers and everything. This kid has peripheral vision that's incredible. She's also probably the best shot maker herself in the game, but she's able to put both of them together, and she understands the concept of team play. When I played as a kid, Rick, I don't know about you when you played, but when I played as a kid, we had a guy on the team, they didn't call it a point guard at that time, but he controlled the game.
Mm-hmm.
He could average, if he wanted to, 40 points a game. But he distributed the ball. He was very bright. He understood that to have all the guys in the team involved in the game, it was very important as a team so we could win. And I'll tell you something that used to happen, and I'm sure the same thing happens with Paige when she delivers the ball. When this guy used to pass the ball to me, it was almost, you do this in a split second, but it was almost like an honor that he passed the ball to me. And I was 1,000% focused. I had to make that shot because he passed me the ball. What an incredible, it was so wonderful what he did to incorporate me into the team flow. I believe that the shooting percentage of people that receive the ball from a pure point guard is way beyond what the normal shooting percentage would be of any person that, shoots normally. It's incredible what a pure point guard can do. If you want to watch pure point guard play, she's playing tonight in the national championship.
Yeah. Bob, thank you for the call, and thank you for bringing up Paige Bueckers, because she is an absolute joy to watch. And for those basketball fans, if you haven't seen UConn play with Paige, I mean, she's just a delight because, yeah, she gets it. She gets the big picture. She's unbelievably talented. You just know when the ball is in her hand that either she's going to make something happen, make a great pass, drive to the hoop, make a great shot. She is just she's just tremendous. Hey, Noah, I got to take a break here. And unfortunately, I have to move on to some other topics this morning. But as always, it's always really good to talk basketball with you. I know that sometimes you and I are on different ends of the spectrum, but I certainly respect your perspective because obviously you played the game at a high level and obviously cover the game now for ESPN. So I thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
Talk to you again soon, I'm sure. That is Noah Savage from ESPN. All right, let me take a timeout. When I come back, I got some other topics I want to discuss with you, so stay with me. All right, let me give you this follow-up ending to my South Bend White Sox story. Now, if you, as I mentioned last week, if you go to my website at AskCoachWolf.com, when you get to the website, just go to the podcast page and you'll see the video package of my three-day playing stint in South Bend, Indiana, when I hit 571. And yep, that really happened. And as promised, here's the kicker to that true story. When the South Bend White Sox went on to win the Midwest League Championship that season, 1989, I was thrilled when the team voted that I should receive a league championship ring. Look, I only played in three games, but, you know, technically I did end up leading the team and hitting with a 571 batting average. And then the following spring, the South Bend general manager, the franchise, invited me to their opening game to throw out the first pitch. It was wonderful stuff. Just great, great memories. But there's more. Okay, a few years later, one of my teammates on that South Bend White Sox team was a talented left-handed pitcher named Scott Rudinsky. I'm sure baseball fans remember Scott. He not only made it to the bigs, but he had a long and a fine career as a relief pitcher. In any event, it was probably in, I'm going to say, 1993. And now I'm working for the Cleveland Indians as their roving sports psychology coach. One day, before a game between the White Sox and the Indians in Cleveland, I'm in uniform, I'm out on the field, I'm talking to Indians players as a part of my job, and the White Sox were out doing their stretching and calisthenics and so on and so forth. One of those White Sox players was Scott Rudinsky. So he sees me, and he sees my name on the back of my Cleveland Indians uniform, and he sort of walks over to me and he says, you know, mind you, I'm now in my 40s. And Scott very innocently and but very sincerely says to me, hey, Rick, are you now playing for Cleveland? That is an absolutely true story. And it was very much the very, very best compliment anyone has ever paid to me in my athletic career. I mean, think, he thought I was really playing for the Indians. Simple as that. But then again, from Scott's perspective, he saw me play and hit 571. Okay, let's move on. Let's take to our callers here. Let's go to Jack Smithlin over in Fairlawn. Jack knows something about hitting. Jack, good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, Rick. I'm doing okay. Well, real quick on the basketball thing. You want to see passing? Take the shot clock away. I remember watching years ago. I remember watching Brown, I think, play Harvard. Mm-hmm. I'm not positive if those were the two teams. And I think the game ended 12-10. And, you know, back then you could stall. You could throw the ball around the key 1,000 times and nothing happened. And, you know, I think passing is a very, very important part of the game because, you know, it adds to the game, of course. I had a girl that was a hitter for me. I was her private hitting coach. She played for Woodridge High School. She was also a great basketball player. Now, she scored 2,000 points in her high school career.
Pretty impressive.
Never made a three, and led the team every year in assists. This kid is phenomenal.
That's pretty good.
Brilliant. But
I just want to say, you know, I happen to be a proponent of the shot clock because I do recall those games in the 70s where teams decided to say, well, we'll get an early lead, be up by 2 or 3 points, you know, 6-3 or something. That'd be the score. Right. And then the guards would just basically dribble the ball endlessly for the rest of the game and pass to each other. It was boring. So right. I do like the shot clock. It adds a little more emphasis on to be able to move the ball quickly and make some progress with it. But go on, Jack.
I think during that game, I think I fell asleep, and when I woke up, it was 12-10. So it was very boring. But let's talk about the hitting part.
Yes.
First of all, I watched the video, and what you did, believe it or not, was amazing. And one of the things that I watched, because I always watch hitters, you didn't have a long swing.
Nope.
You were up on the bat. You just put the ball in play. You got the barrel to the ball with force. Because, believe it or not, I don't know whether you realize it or not, but back then, when you were playing, and even I was playing, and, you know, I mean, I never got to your level in baseball, but you hit rotationally. You hit with a lower half. You used every ounce of your body to put the ball in play. And, you know, when I showed it to some of my hitters, I actually showed that at my college practice the other day. And I showed it to a few of the girls that are having hitting problems, and I said, this is the complete opposite of a long bat, a long swing. Short to the ball, long through the ball, and just put it in play. Now, you also had another attribute that really worked is you were very quick. You were a fast runner, it looked like. So hitting is, you know, what you did at that age, it was just amazing. It really was amazing.
Well, you're very kind.
You know, I
was going to say, Jack, if the video shows, obviously, that I'm in my late 30s. Obviously, unfortunately, from the time I had finished, you know, playing in my early 20s, I was about 20, 30 pounds lighter. But to the short stroke, I mean, my very first professional bat in the minor leagues back when I was probably, 21, 22. First, I hit a triple to right center. I really just laced the ball. And also my very last at bat playing minor league baseball, I singled sharply to center field. Unfortunately, I don't have many other hits between those two. But, you know, I learned from Al Goldust, the Hall of Fame scout, you got to have a short stroke because you're never going to make enough, you're not going to have enough time to take a big long stroke to make contact against a ball that's coming in the low 90s or mid 90s. So that was a valuable lesson I had to learn because I was in high school. I had a long, big stroke, like Ted Williams used to always advocate in his book. But the fact is that would not work for me at the pro level. So I had to make an adjustment.
You know, and Ted said the same thing. He said his swing back then would not work today. I mean, when you're hitting a 90 mile an hour fastball, a baseball hitter has less than 0.4 seconds to react. When you're hitting a 60 mile an hour fast pitch softball from 43 feet away, you have less than 0.3 seconds to react. So when you talk about reaction time, you know, the shortest distance between 2 points is a straight line. Getting that barrel to that ball as quick as possible. But what you did was amazing. It really was. And I actually did use it, and I showed it to a few of my girls that have this long swing, and I'm trying to get their hands inside and all the stuff that you talk about with me. And I've actually talked to Al, and Al and I are on the same page when it comes to hitting. And, you know, and I'm glad that you connected me with him. But also the stuff that Noah said is amazing. And, you know, the passing part of it is very important in the game of basketball. In fact, in hockey and soccer, you can have 2 assists on a score. So passing is important. They rate it, they grade it, and you get credit for it. So I like passing. Shooting is great. You want points to be scored. You know, I mean, bringing it back, throwing, you know, having great passers who can be a four-tool player. They can play defense, they can dribble, they can jump and shoot and pass. Those are great attributes. That adds to a great game of basketball.
Oh, I agree.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Jack, thank you as always for your thoughts and your kind words. And the reason why I like to have Noah come on the show is because of the fact that he knows the game of basketball so well. I don't know of any other person who is more connected to the game at all different levels. And obviously he grew up with a passion for the sport, but he also brings a perspective to the sport that, quite frankly, is often sometimes contrary to what my perception is. And he obviously does homework. He knows what he's talking about. And I think he's just a breath of fresh air when it comes to telling me, and obviously you, about how the game of basketball is being played these days and what goes through the minds of college coaches, NBA scouts, what they're really looking for in terms of finding the next great superstar in terms of the world of hoops. Let's move on with our calls. Let's go to Nick over in New Jersey. Hey, Nick, good morning. You're on the Fan.
Morning, Coach.
Hi, Nick.
I'm on the last segment about basketball, but if
go ahead.
You're all done,
go ahead.
Oh, my take on basketball is that when they changed the game, I'm 75, so I played when we were taught, move the ball, get it inside, move the ball, look for the open shot on the outside. But they allowed, with the changes, and I mean the changes in, you know, what the kids do today, or the young gentlemen, with this carrying the ball, all that would have been a walk, a carry on us.
Yes.
Every kid that dribbles today grabs it from underneath over, grabs it from... So I feel they were able to develop more because they're allowed to get away with more.
Uh-huh.
So then it becomes a showboat because they can drive this way and that way. I'm not sure that the athletes are any... They're bigger, but I'm not sure they're any greater than the old athletes would have been had they been allowed to do the stuff they do today. That was my take on it. I told Ed going in, I have, you know, it's always my opinion. Except at home, it's my wife's opinion.
Well said. Hey, thanks for the call, Nick. And, you know, we all have noticed the fact that in today's game, there's a much more leeway in terms of the dribblers and the guys bringing the ball up court than, you know, maybe 20 years ago, you'd be called for palming the ball or for a travel. Not so much these days. And maybe it actually helps the kids in terms of being able to direct the ball to make a quicker, sharper pass. I don't know. But the fact is, it's become sort of like part of the action now. Nobody seems to ever complain. And if somebody were called for you know, carrying the ball or palming the ball, as it used to be called, I mean, it would be kind of like, what are we doing that for? I mean, that's why are you making that call? So I think the fact that everybody sort of universally accepted this as being part of the game today, that's just how it goes, simple as that. Let's continue with our calls if we can. Let's go over to Ron in Greenwich. Good morning, Ron. You're next up on the Fan.
Thanks, Rick. I got three things to say. How about Pistol Pete Maravich?
Yeah.
That's right. Nobody mentioned him. And for baseball, how about Tony Gwynn's hitting video?
Two for two. I mean, you know, okay. Pistol Pete was a pleasure to watch because he not only could score, he could pass in a very circus-like kind of way. And yeah. Gwynn, of course, is all about hitting the ball where it's pitched, short stroke, and a great, great all-time hitter.
And if you ever saw that NBA game where Pistol Pete scored, what, 50-some games or 50-some points?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those are the three things nobody's mentioned today. Okay, I'll get off. Go ahead.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate the call. Yeah, I mean, look, basketball, baseball, these are sports with long, long histories. And, you know, we know that sports usually go around in cycles. But, you know, I'm glad that you know, Ron reminded us that Pistol Pete Maravich, when he played in college at LSU and obviously in the NBA, I mean, this was a guy who brought a different kind of a refreshing approach to the game. Yeah, he could score, and he scored a lot all the time. But he also was amazing in terms of seeing the court, seeing the open man, and when obviously other teams tried to clamp down on Maravich, he found the open guy to make a quick pass and an easy score. And obviously with Tony Gwynn, look, there are all sorts of great, great hitters, but Tony really made it into an everyday practice of learning how to discipline himself with a short stroke. Tony Gwynn was not, of course, a home run hitter. He was a guy who put the ball in play, used the entire field. He gave what the pitcher gave him in terms of hitting the ball to where it was pitched. That's something that we often concern ourselves these days, with baseball, because we worry that maybe the players today are just all about trying to hit home runs. And, you know, if they learn more to put the ball, hit it where it's pitched. I mean, I was watching the Yankee game yesterday in the spring training game, and Aaron Hicks gets up and puts down a perfect bunt down the third baseline. It wasn't like it was, it wasn't very like the last second. He just basically sort of squared around, said, "I'm going to put a bunt down," and the bunt went down the third baseline. And of course, there was nobody who could get it because the Orioles were in a shift. And before you know it, I mean, Hicks walked down to first base with a base hit. That is real baseball. That's how the game is supposed to be played. You give what the pitcher gives you. You take it. You take what the infield or outfield gives you. That's how the game is supposed to be played. Okay, look, before I forget, I do want to just wrap up the show by talking about that sort of impromptu survey that I went through last week on the show, because there's obviously critically important stuff. And look, there's no question that the biggest concern for all of us still seems to focus on parents being much too involved and much too overbearing in terms of their interactions with coaches and officials and the expectations that they place on their kids in terms of sports. And to me, the operative word here is friction. Friction among parents and coaches and kids. The parents and their expectations for their youngsters just seem to add a layer of unwanted friction into our equation. And as we know, this friction, these things didn't exist a generation or two ago when sports parents didn't interfere with coaches, and they just let their kids go out and play on their own. But so until we finally figure this out, I'm afraid we're going to have this, again, this term I use of friction, it's going to continue in youth and amateur and sports. And maybe the time has just come to be even more honest about this, and for coaches and parents to meet in their towns and communities and really directly talk about these issues. Maybe that's the best approach, that at least if moms and dads and coaches are communicating directly about what we really want for our kids to enjoy about sports, then perhaps the parents would think twice about confronting the coach or getting involved. And I do think that's an idea worth considering. No, I'm not talking about a preseason meeting where a coach hands out a sheet of paper to remind parents to behave. No. I'm thinking we need a much more comprehensive and open and interactive session with the coaches and the parents and the athletic director to discuss what our priorities are and to get these out in the open. We really, really need the parents to understand that our kids' coaches are truly working hard to improve our kids and to get them to reach their full athletic potential. And again, parents, it's okay to dream, but we have to be much more realistic about our youngsters' true abilities. And we have to find a way to calm ourselves and to try and see our kids' abilities in the same way that the rest of the world does. You have to be objective. It's as simple as that. Okay, that's going to do it for me in this edition of The Sports Edge. My thanks, as always, to Ed Arzuman. Mark Melusis, the Moose, is up next. I'll see you next week right here on The Sports Edge.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.